This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
People who are defenseless against the powerful now finds herself in the same communications management unit in Carswell, Texas, that Susan Lindauer managed to survive. This time, survival does not look good. We'll get to that in just a minute. First, this, on April 3rd, the story broke that the port of Coos Bay had laid off three people and dropped out of another hiring plan. They said that this was to save money for dredging. Really? Dredging, eh? Well, since the dredging is $800,000, either the port can't do the math, or the $170,000 that they saved for the dredging was actually needed for something else, perhaps a new lobbyist, maybe? A lobbyist for from the energy industry for Jordan Cove, perhaps? You do have to wonder. The port goes ahead and lays off what we refer to as little people. But what about the consultants? It seems like there's always room in the budget to hire a few more consultants and lobbyists. And there's a lot more happening down there. And of course, this was just in time for a critical meeting at a time when the state and the port of Coos Bay has no money, supposedly, and is cutting all kinds of programs and jobs. They seem to have plenty of money to pay for these lobbyists. There are meetings coming up Monday, April 8th. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, is proposing to update the flood insurance rate maps countywide, including the cities of Coos Bay. And, of course, FEMA's preparing an official map that displays flood plans. And, again, this is exactly where the lobbyists come in, because this is going to play a critical role in whether or not an LNG terminal does go online at Jordan Cove. This is a disaster awaiting the Oregon coast, yet one more insult to the environment. Here's another one. They found Clackamas County they never stop. They never stop. If you want a news story, go to Clackamas County. It's always something. This time, the sheriff's deputies out there responded to a tip and found an enormous 4-foot alligator in a shed. The alligator was removed by people who know how to remove alligators. The people from the zoo who do these kinds of things. Alligator goes by the name of Wally. A suggestion for Mayor Cascadia is, I think it ought to be immediately elected to the Clackamas County Board of Commissioners, where it will find its true calling. And a man in Oregon City, while he was actually in undergoing sentencing for a crime that was not that severe, took out a razor and attempted to cut his own throat in the courtroom. And they say that our current correction system doesn't inspire fear. Democrats in Oregon House are releasing more information about their plan to raise tax revenue from wealthy individuals and businesses. And, of course, that includes the lobbyists in Coos Bay, hopefully. Woodpeckers, again, might save the environment. It remains to be seen if this woodpecker in question is placed on the endangered species list. This black-backed woodpecker might, again, play a role in defending the last of Cascadia's forests. We want to talk a little bit about, again, prisons, returning to prisons and the system that exists in this country today. We will be speaking later with Ralph Sherman. Right now, though, Ralph Sherman is with us right now. Good morning, Ralph. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Trish.
Well, Briefly, for listeners who aren't familiar with Lynn Stewart, could you bring us up to speed and who she is and how she wound up in one of these things called a communications management unit? These are rarely in the news. We don't. The general public knows very little about them. They are, in fact, prisons where some prisoners are administered say, drugs to keep them quiet if the walls don't work. Marie Mason is in one. I believe she's in Coswell. Susan Lindauer was in one. And now Lynn Stewart is in one. And their function is to terrorize and silence people who are outspoken. And these would be America's expanding cadre of political prisoners. Can you bring us up to speed on Lynn, though?
Yes, Lynn Stewart is a noted civil liberties attorney who is most renowned for her defense of the most targeted, vulnerable, oppressed, impoverished, notably black blacks targeted by the police and state. And she has national renown for her service as a defense attorney for the least advantaged. Now, Lynn Stewart had been often appointed by federal judges to defend clients that no one was willing to defend. So, for example, she was appointed as the lawyer for Sammy the Bull Gravano, a mafia hitman, who she defended against the government frame-up, actually. But with respect to the case for which he is now in prison, this concerns the blind Egyptian cleric Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman, who was set up by the FBI in a putative plot to blow up what were called the New York landmarks. Namely, this sheikh was accused of being plotting and organizing the blowing up of the Statue of Liberty, the George Washington Bridge, the Lincoln Tunnel, the Holland Tunnel, the United Nations building, and assassinating the then Secretary General Boutros Ghali and Senator Alphonse D'Amato. The sheikh is a blind
he's an elderly gentleman too, isn't
yeah, so a blind
seems
Egyptian
like a
cleric in
tall
his 70s,
order. Go ahead, sorry.
Who has advanced diabetes, which means that his fingers have no sensation, so he can't read Braille. He speaks no English. He is indigent. He had a walk-up mosque in New Jersey and a walk-up mosque in Brooklyn, and his constituents were impoverished immigrant kids who were working as dishwashers or taxi cab drivers. Into this comes the FBI operative Emad Ali Salem, an Egyptian intelligence operative operating out of the New York office of the FBI. And he goes into the mosque of the blind sheikh, and he starts to suggest that the youngsters come to a meeting. And there he talks about blowing up this and blowing up that. And most of them ran when confronted by this. A couple of them said, "Are we on television?" It was the most crude, absurd frame-up. Can you imagine that the elderly sheikh, with no means, no English, is capable of organizing and carrying out the bombing of all these major landmarks into the eye of the intelligence agencies in the heart of New York City? It's an absurdity. He had no more to do with this than my grandmother. So Lynn Stewart was appointed as his attorney, and she joined with former Attorney General Ramsey Clark and the noted civil liberties lawyer Abdin Jabbar in defending the blind sheikh. But the evidence for his innocence pointed to the role of the United States authorities themselves, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, in these events, and that pertained to the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center as well. In these circumstances, when presenting the evidence for his innocence, the government tried to entrap and to demonize and to imprison Lynn Stewart. And what they did was to assimilate the lawyer into the putative crime of the person she was defending. So, for example, if a lawyer is defending someone accused of murder, by offering defense, they are then called accessories to the act of murder itself. Lynn Stewart was framed in this way by John Ashcroft, the Attorney General of George Bush, who flew to the David Letterman show and announced on television that he was going to charge the terrorist lawyer, Lynn Stewart, for aiding and abetting terrorism by virtue of defending the blind sheikh. Now, this is an attack on the entire framework of due process, constitutional rights, civil liberties, and it terrorizes every lawyer in the United States who has to consider that if they attempt to defend someone falsely accused who the state wants to demonize, they themselves will be assimilated to the crime of the person they are defending merely for the act of defending them. The great crime of Lynn Stewart was that she issued a press release to Reuters about the opinions and situation of her client. Her co-counsel, Attorney General Ramsey Clark, had issued at least 40 of these press releases. They defied the what were called the special administrative measures that Ashcroft imposed, which was supposed to gag lawyers about the situation of their clients, while the government uses the media as a bully puppet to create a drumbeat of hysteria with their propaganda about the case. That's the basis for Lynn Stewart being charged with being a material aid to terrorism.
Ralph, we're running out of time. We're running out of time. That is something that people don't know. People should know, and it is absolutely imperative to get the information out.
Well,
can you tell people? Can you let our listeners know what the situation is right now and why it's so important to sign the petition?
Lynn Stewart was immediately sent to prison, although the case was pending before the courts. She was prevented from having a surgery for which she was scheduled at St. Luke's Hospital in New York. She had breast cancer, which was in remission. The surgery was delayed by virtue of the fact that she was sent to prison. The prison has no medical facilities, and they denied her both access to her surgery and the medication which she required. They delayed that surgery 18 months. It was a calamity. The surgeon said it was the worst case he'd ever seen. In consequence, her breast cancer metastasized. It had been in remission before, and it is now in her lungs, her lymph nodes, her scapula, and her spine. She is in stage 4 cancer, and they are denying her access to the medical attention which could save her life. In fact, to give you the flavor of what happens here, Lynn Stewart is shackled with 10 to 20 pounds of shackles and chains on her wrists and her ankles when she has to move anywhere. When she goes in for a medical examination, which is rare enough, she's shackled.
We're out of time. We have to take this up again tomorrow. I'm going to put the information, post that petition on the KBOO website. That was Ralph Schoenemann. You've heard it. That's it. That's the state of that we are in this country right now. This has been Echo Cascadia for Tuesday, April 9th. Janet Anderson engineered the show today. Carlos Chavez, Kathy Stevenson is the KBO AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts. Know your rights. Take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
Today on Flashpoints, we feature a special report on tens of thousands of Iraqis forced out of their country by an illegal U.S. war and now struggling to get by and make ends meet in El Cajon, California, between San Diego and the U.S.-Mexico border. And 35 years after the first major anti-nuclear action in the U.S., we'll feature the sounds of Seabrook 1977, a documentary made in April 1977 that marks this crucial formal beginning of the new anti-nuclear movement that employed widespread civil disobedience to make its point. I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. A decade after U.S. forces sealed their victory over Iraq by tearing down the statue of Saddam Hussein, Iraqis continue to flee their country, adding to the estimated 4 million displaced by the war and occupation. The Progressive magazine has a new report on the largest community of Iraqi refugees in the United States who fled as a result of the U.S. war and occupation. Joining us to talk about that report is Arun Gupta. He is the author and he's a widely published journalist. You can see his stuff all over the place in the Progressive, Truth Out, In These Times, The Guardian. It is good to have you with us on Flashpoints.
Great to be with you today, Dennis.
Okay, well, even as we covered that war and the unfolding of that war, we saw that first tens of thousands, then hundreds of thousands, then millions of Iraqis were in fact displaced internally and then fled the country. you write about a situation in Southern California where many are. I'm hoping that you can just set the scene, outline the situation, what's happening down there, paint a picture, and who it is that is struggling there at near the U.S. southern, U.S.-Mexico border.
Well, this is actually a really fascinating story of how I even found the story. So in March of 2012, an Iraqi-American woman, Shema Alawadi, is murdered in her home in El Cajon, California. She's beaten to the point of death and later dies in a hospital. A note is left next to her body that says, "Go back to your country, you terrorist." I wasn't too far away at the time, so I thought I would go down there and check out the story because it became this international sensation of, you know, this potential hate crime, murder. In Southern California, we know that this area is kind of a hotbed for xenophobia, Islamophobia, a lot of anti-immigrant violence. And when I get down there a few days after her death, the information starts to come out pointing to the family. That it may have been someone in the family who actually did it. And there were things that right away tipped off that it probably wasn't some random hate crime, because for a woman to be attacked, for it to happen in her home, highly unusual in terms of these types of hate crimes. But when I get there, I realize, wait a minute, there's this enormous Iraqi-American community here. This is about half an hour east of San Diego, in kind of the foothills of these mountains, this semi-arid, almost desert-like landscape. And upon doing further research, I find that there's something like over 30,000 Iraqi-Americans. And I'm like, how did 30,000 Iraqis wind up in the desert of Southern California? Now, the murdered woman, Shema Alawadi, she was a Shia, and so I was engaging largely with the Shia community there in terms of interviewing, talking to people about what possibly happened. But a lot of the people who are talking to told me, oh, you know, it's really, this is